Hello and welcome to Contact Chai. Today's episode is a Shabbat replay of our March 29th Friday night service, when Rabbi Lissy delivered a fascinating drosh about how the rabbis reshaped Judaism after the fall of the Second Temple. How did they transform a religion based on sacrifices, like the ones found in this week's Parsha, into one based on the study of Torah we know today? How did Judaism survive when so many ancient civilizations did not? Take it away, Rabbi.
So, as Rabbi Stephen mentioned earlier, this week we open up the Torah and read a fairly typical parsha for the book of Leviticus. And God said to Moses, "Command Aaron and his sons thus, this is the ritual of the burnt offering. The burnt offering itself shall remain where it is burnt upon the altar all night until morning, where the fire on the altar is kept going on it," etc., etc. Laws and directions about sacrifices. So rabbi of the, or she's, like, you know what, in my thing I wrote rabbi. She's not a rabbi. She's a very smart Orthodox teacher, but her name is Aviva Gottlieb Zorenberg. Her book on Leviticus is called The Hidden Order of Intimacy. Doesn't that sound hot for a book about sacrifices? And this refers to the fact that in biblical Judaism, sacrifice was actually the primary way of building intimacy with the divine. So the hidden order of intimacy, the very specific directions, the Seder, of creating that closeness with God. Sacrifice in Hebrew is korban, which comes from the same Hebrew word karov, as closeness, as intimacy. And so that intimacy, you know, it's born from the human need. Again, Rabbi Stephen mentioned earlier, the needs that we have for gratitude and to make atonement and to mark transitions between sickness and health, or between states of ritual impurity to purity, or a state of exile to being welcomed back in the community, paying taxes, supporting the community. All of these are different human needs that actually the priest had very detailed instructions for how to fulfill all of these needs for the people in the ancient world through making sacrifices. And people would bring their pain and their sorrow and their gratitude and also their first fruits and their children, not to sacrifice, but to like give money in exchange for not having to sacrifice their children. And the priests knew just what to do in just what order and just what way to propitiate God on their behalf and build a sense of closeness and intimacy with the divine on behalf of the Jewish people. And more than once, this story and this ability to attain that kind of divine closeness came to a screeching halt when in 586 BCE, the Babylonians destroyed the temple in Jerusalem and the altar on which these sacrifices took place. And then, of course, and then it was rebuilt, and then they went back to doing the old thing. And then again, in the year 70 CE, the Romans came and did the same thing, decimating the central Jewish way of connecting with the divine. And this time, there was a kind of finality to the destruction wrought by the Romans. And by all accounts, our religion and our people should have died with the death of those rituals. But we're still here. And we're still reading the story of these rituals. And we're still reading the book of Leviticus without practicing almost anything in it. So Rabbi Jonathan Sacks comments that unlike many ancient societies in which, when faced with an existential crisis or threat, those ancient societies turned even more to what you might call the irrational rituals of propitiating gods with sacrifices, Judaism did the opposite. Instead of focusing on how to keep telling the same story again and again of how closeness is achieved with God, our ancient rabbis focused instead on finding substitutes for sacrifice, planning for the worst case scenario in which the central meeting place of their religious life would actually be over, would be destroyed, and then need to imagine a future that was not going to be reliant on a single place or edifice to survive. And so he describes six, and this is six of many more substitutes for sacrifices that the rabbis of the Mishnah and the Talmud identified. And I'll share them with you now. One of them is, actually, anybody want to guess what are some of these substitutes for ancient sacrifice that we currently practice? Prayer, thank you very much. And by the way, every one of these things like has a biblical citation that the rabbis go, you know how we know that this is, you know, that this was actually what God intended when God wrote the Torah? And then they cite a particular verse. So the one for prayer is from Hosea, from the prophet Hosea, where it says, take words with you and return to the Lord. We will offer our lips as sacrifices of bulls. They go, our lips, right? Our words, not sacrifices, our words. Okay, ding, ding, ding. Yeah. Well, the dining room table, hospitality, actually, like the creating of holy space, all of the rituals, for example, around a Shabbat table, making kiddush, blessing bread, all of those had like analogs in the sacrificial service. Which, by the way, if you go into a Catholic service, I did this once with I really wanted to go to midnight mass, and my Jewish friend who grew up Catholic was like, I'll take you and I'll explain it all to you. Like, I'm not going to like it, but I'll do it. And as the priest was going through all of the rituals, she was saying, Kiddush, Hamotzi, Nitilat Yadayim, you know? And so actually, yes, like the physical objects around the table obviously the entire ritual of Yom Kippur, right? Everything that we do, fasting. Fasting is another substitute for sacrifice. Any other guesses? Tzedakah. Very nice. Charity. Okay. Study. Yes. Studying Torah. Okay. I'm not going to go through and give you all of these citations and all the Psalms and the prophets, but if you want to see them, then this will be up on the website later with the transcript. And what the rabbis were doing, and this is all, by the way, this is in the Mishnah and this is in the Talmud. This is the reason why we still exist today is because our very creative rabbis of yore replaced sacrifice with all of these things and many more. And so what the rabbis were doing was writing a new story. And the rabbis who survived in the shadow of the Roman destruction could no longer go to the temple. And after the Bar Kokhba revolt, about 65 years after the temple's destruction, Jews were not even allowed into Jerusalem. So there was no hope of returning and rebuilding and going back to the old way. They inherited a story that had crashed and that was no longer going to serve them. And Rabbi Sacks writes, what's striking in hindsight is how rather than clinging obsessively to the past, leaders like Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai thought forward to worst case scenarios. And the great question raised by Parshat Tzav, this week's Torah portion, which is all about all these different kinds of sacrifices, is not why were sacrifices offered and commanded in the first place? Because they were all over the ancient world. You know, we're not the only society that has an ancient sacrificial story. So it's not why were there sacrifices in the first place, but rather, given how central sacrifices were to religious life in ancient Israel, how did Judaism survive without them? And so the short answer is overwhelmingly that the prophets and the sages and the Jewish thinkers of the Middle Ages realized that sacrifices could be expressed in other ways. They were ancient embodiments of heart and mind and deed, but they weren't the only way to express those things. And so we can encounter the will of God, you know, or the will of the divine, however you want to call it, through Torah study, through engaging in acts of service and prayer, making financial sacrifices, and the structures to make these communal and personal acts of divine closeness don't have to be in one central place. In fact, it's actually kind of dangerous for them to be all located in one place. And they can be built anywhere and would sustain Jewish identity, even the most adverse conditions, anywhere in the world. And he writes, most of the world's great civilizations have, in time, become extinct, while Judaism has survived. He says, could have been divine providence, but more likely, it was the foresight of people like Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai who resisted cognitive breakdown and did not seek refuge in the irrational and created solutions today for the problems of tomorrow and quietly built the Jewish future. And lest we think that this kind of creativity and brazen reinterpretation of the tradition is inevitable, or was inevitable then, because after all, here we are, you know, it had to have happened that way. Let me remind you some other ways it could have gone. At the time of the rabbis who reinvented our tradition, there were also zealots who were committed to fighting the Romans until the last Jewish soldier was felled. They're not around anymore. There were the Karaites who resisted reinterpreting anything in the Torah and continued to take it all as God's literal word. There are not many of them around anymore either. There were people who saw the Roman defeat of the Jews as evidence that God clearly had abandoned us, and they just assimilated into Roman society. That was the vast majority of people. And then, of course, in addition to Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, if you've seen The Life of Brian, you know, there were many other leaders reinterpreting the old stories back in ancient Israel at that time, too, creating new testaments on top of the old one. And that's a new story, too. The tradition that we have inherited, this new way of interpreting these old things, these sacrifices, was not inevitable. And I want to explore now what this kind of looks like for us today, what this has looked like and can look like. So if you joined us on Saturday night for the raucous, zany holiday of Purim, and you made it through our spiel in which I revealed my intention to never come back to Mishkan after my sabbatical, like ever, and then my alter ego staged a profane and hilarious hostile takeover when I realized what the other options were. If you made it through all of that, and then you made it through the first 8 chapters of the Megillah, and you were still in the room and somewhat sober, then you will remember what I'm about to describe. In chapter 9 of Megillat Esther, the scroll of Esther, the Jews who have been quaking with fear at the prospect of the fulfillment of Haman's evil decree to annihilate them all, men, women, children, babies, are given permission to fight back. And fight back they do. And they first slaughter 500 Shushanians, killing not only Haman, the diabolical leader of the planned genocide against them. They then impale 10 of his sons. And then the next day they slaughter another 300 people, and they hang the impaled bodies of Haman's sons. And then in a final act of what some would call self-defense and others would call pure, unadulterated, bloodlust revenge, the Jews slaughter 75,000 people. And then they rest and eat and drink and create the holiday of Purim that we will then celebrate for the next 2,500 years, bringing us into this very moment. And so if you were in the room, you know that before chapter 9, we stopped. We paused the revelry of the night to draw attention to what might be obvious, but was important to name anyway, which is this story hits a little too close to home this year. And we can't read it without doing something to register that we, as inheritors of this story, cannot just keep telling it as if reality hasn't changed around us. As if we aren't bothered by the story. As if we aren't bothered by the reality in the human psyche that the story reflects. And most importantly, as if we aren't bothered about the reality in this world that the story parallels so disturbingly. And so we read those verses in a different trope. Instead of in the joyful Purim trope, we read them in Eicha trope, which is the holiday associated with the destruction and heartbreak of the solemn fast day of Tisha B'Av. And we invited people to sit on the floor, a traditional Jewish mourning practice. And I think for those of us who engaged in this practice, in this moment, it was both powerful and hard. And even if people didn't actually do all the stuff, I think it was challenging. It was a challenging ritual moment. And it also helped us internalize that we don't just inherit these stories without question or challenge or reflection. The best part of planning a holiday is asking ourselves, in the style of the rabbis who came before us, how do we adapt what we have inherited so that we can learn lessons for this moment, right? We adapt or interpret our texts and our rituals, lest they lose relevance, lest they become so inflexible over time that they and we break when pressed by the ethical demands of the moment. A mentor of mine in the for-profit sector often says to leaders that are weary of the need to innovate and change with the changing times, says, "You think change is hard? Try irrelevance. right? All our inherited stories were written in a particular time and place. And the Purim story was written in the time and place when the indignities of Jewish powerlessness were so abject that the idea of attaining the social status, that the idea of Jews attaining the social status of queen and first advisor to the king was hilarious to imagine. You know, it's a satire. It was funny. And the idea of Jews taking violent, bloody revenge on those who wished them harm was emotionally satisfying in the way that watching Inglourious Basterds might have been emotionally satisfying. I think that was already like, over a decade ago. Or watching Alec Baldwin or James Austin Johnson do a Trump interpretation on SNL used to be satisfying. But times change. And if our stories don't change, then we've got a problem. And so for any of you familiar with B'nai Lapi's crash theory, you know what happens when the story we've inherited crashes into our lived reality, and it becomes impossible to intellectually or morally justify continuing hold on to a particular story we've inherited. At which point we have three options. Option one is build a wall around the story. It's our story, after all. If we don't tell it, who will? If we change it, we don't know what will happen. And that's scary. If we build a wall around the story and around ourselves, then we can tell ourselves that the world hasn't changed, and we can keep telling the story that we've inherited, which is comforting on many levels, even if we know it doesn't work anymore. Option one relies heavily on nostalgia. And as the moral and political philosopher Hannah Arendt has said, nostalgia is a tool of authoritarians. Option one lulls us into thinking we can go backward, which can be very comforting. And then there's option two, walk away. Walk away from the story. Walk away from it all. Leave it all behind. Move to Canada, right? Take up a new religion, right? If the story doesn't work anymore, give it up. Not only is the story bad and harmful, everything about the tradition that gave birth to it is also tainted irreparably. The only rational solution is to stop telling the story and find a completely new story, never mind that that story will also eventually crash. And then finally, there's option three. Figure out how to adapt, adjust, revise, update, reboot the old story so you get the benefits of the old story, because there were many benefits after all, but not the harm. You use the old story to tell a new story. You do what the rabbis of the Mishnah and the Talmud taught us to do 2,000 years ago. And so this year, our friends at the Shalom Center in Philadelphia, Rabbi Arthur Waskow and Rabbi Nate DeGroote, invited writers and rabbis to write a new and different ending for Chapter 9 of the Megillah. And if you go to the Chapter 9 Project website, you'll see what they say. Is if we imagine the 5th century Jews' response to their almost annihilation, how would we wish the story had unfolded differently? If we apply a worldview that seeks peace, love for all humans, and recognizes every person as created in the image of God, what is the ending we and the world long for? In this moment, new endings are being called into existence, both in the Purim story, and they write in Israel and Palestine. Let's channel those stories together. And so at ICAR in Los Angeles, which is our sister community, or maybe the mothership, depending on how you think about it, Rabbi Brous invited the community during Chapter 9 to hold up signs during the reading of the chapter that said, write a new story. And then while reading, while hearing the traditional Hebrew text, they shared on the screen a new text for Chapter 9 by Rabbi Sheila Peltz-Weinberg, which I will read to you now. Queen Esther, the beloved of the king, and her foster dad, Mordechai, were now recognized as Jews by the king and the court. They were seen as worthy of respect and care. The king was ready to author a letter reversing Haman's decree to exterminate every Jew, man, woman, and child, in the province of his vast kingdom and to confiscate their property. Esther and Mordechai sat together. They sat in silence. They sat in contemplation. Their lives and the lives of their people had been profoundly threatened. And now, was it possible that the decree could be reversed? had the poison unleashed by Haman's jealousy, pride, and greed seeped into the pores of the people among whom the Jews lived? Mordechai turned to his beloved Esther and said, "Should we encourage the Jews to avenge themselves on their neighbors? Are those people our enemy? Haman and his sons were executed. They are no more. Who are our enemies? Who deserves to be the victims of our trauma?" Esther was still. She had risked her life by pleading with the king and had brought about this incredible reversal of fate. She knew she had saved her people, but she thought, maybe they needed revenge. Maybe the threat will not disappear until the Jews are triumphant and we slaughter them as they would have slaughtered us. It was silent in the room. Each one knew that there was very little time to compose an edict that would reverse Haman's edict. The king had given Esther and Mordechai the assignment to frame the new decree. What did they need to say to their leaders and followers, the Jews and the populations of the many nations that inhabited the vast empire? Suddenly, a magnificent white bird appeared. Its wings were expanded, its feathers translucent. It filled the room with energy and light. Mordechai and Esther gasped as they gazed at the bird. They listened. After a few minutes, Esther spoke. "I know what to do. We will send a message that invites everyone in every province of this vast empire to come to a central space, a space without habitation, an open field. They will bring shovels and they will begin to dig. They will create a great earthen container, and into that container, they will gather all their weapons. The weapons of all the provinces, the soldiers, the police, the guardians, all who might be tempted toward violence, violence toward Jews or violence by Jews, all violent instruments, swords, knives, cannonballs, anything that might harm another human being. All of these weapons will be cast into the cavern. They will cover the huge space, and then we will cover the huge space with earth." She took a long, deep breath and glanced at Mordechai and smiled. She looked at the white bird and sighed. Mordechai said, "And dearest Esther, what do you want to do with that space when the instruments of hatred, cruelty, and war are deeply buried?" "Ah, that is easy," she said. "The people will plant trees and gardens. They will plant vegetables to nourish the poor and the vulnerable, trees for shade and sweet fruit and nuts." Mordechai said, "I love this idea, Esther. Around the perimeter, the people will build playgrounds for children to play and classrooms for children to learn the ways of peace and love." "Yes, dear Mordechai, we will gather the courtiers and send them out with this holy decree. The king has given us his signet ring." And the courtiers went out in urgent haste, and the decree was proclaimed in the fortress Shushan. And the city of Shushan rang with joyous cries. La Yehudim hayta ura v'simcha v'sason v'ikar. And the Jews enjoyed light and gladness, happiness and honor. And in every province and in every city where the king's command and decree had arrived, the Jews and their neighbors went out to find the great space to bury their arms, to plant their trees, and to build their playgrounds and classrooms. True joy for all. So, we now turn from the godless, carnival-like world of Purim to the God-filled, redemptive story of Passover in 3 weeks. And we will sit around tables and retell the story of our ancestors having been slaves in Egypt, Mitzrayim, which of course doesn't actually translate directly to Egypt, certainly not modern-day Egypt, the nation-state. It translates to narrow place, Mitzrayim, place of constriction and limitation. Constriction and limitation, not just of body, but of mind. The Israelites, we read in the Torah, were so oppressed they could not even imagine a different ending to their story. Part of what made Moses' job so hard was that it's hard to inspire people who are unwilling or unable to imagine that the future could be different than the present. But as we all know, being able to imagine a different future is the only thing that makes our survival possible, let alone our thriving. And the best part of practicing tradition that we have inherited is the freedom to take the story, the ritual, the Seder passed down to us, and to tell it in a new way. And we all know the best Seders do not just stop at telling the story in the book, but they open up space for dreaming and imagining and telling new stories and personal stories, imagining future stories built on the foundation of the old story, not being limited or constrained by the old story, but allowing the Haggadah to be, in Rabbi Stevens' words, a sandbox, not a fixed blueprint. So I want to invite us, as the sun begins to warm our bones in this season and the blossoms begin to open and the taste of karpas, the spring greens mix with the salty tears of our past and our present, before we go into the prescribed four questions in the Haggadah, I want us to ask a more foundational question. And that is, what is the story, not that we have been telling, but that we need to tell to take us to the promised land that we envision and pray for? And instead of focusing, as we often do at our Seder, on the question of what is slavery in our world, surely you could spend all night on that conversation, perhaps ask the question of, what does the promised land look like to you? And what will it take to get there? Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Replay is a production of Mishkan Chicago. Our theme music was composed and performed by Kalman Strauss. You can always see where and when our next service will be on our calendar. There's a link in the show notes. And if you appreciated the program, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. I know you've heard it before, but it really does help. On behalf of Team Mishkan, thank you for listening.